Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Here on the podcast, we bring you the best bits of my Times Radio show. We bring you The Big Thing, which we do at 11 o'clock every day on Times Radio, plus the columnist panel, Times columnists picking over the news. But if you want to listen to the whole show, you can join me from 10 till 1 on Times Radio, Monday to Friday. And you can get us on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app, where you can also listen to the Redbox Podcast. So it all joins up. If you want to come on the radio, and why wouldn't you, family, you can play our hugely popular quiz, Can You Get to Number 10? It's very straightforward. There are 10 questions, very loosely connected to 10 cabinet jobs. The more questions you get right, the better the job you get in our cabinet. So if you want to come on and do that, email me now with your name and, crucially, your phone number so we can call you back. Email me matt.chorley@times.radio. And we'll get you on the radio very soon. Now, coming up on today's podcast, it's Armistice Day, the 11th of the 11th. So after marking the 2 minute silence at 11 o'clock, we took a look back at the stories of some of the MPs who served during the First and Second. Morning, India.
Morning.
And in the studio with me is James Marriott. James, how are you?
Good morning. Hello. I'm all right. Sorry, that was a bit robotic.
No, it's very natural. It's absolutely fine. We are talking about... That might be. That's going straight in the Christmas montage of best snorting. Make a note of that. Let's talk about MPs. Because MPs disgracing themselves seems to have been a theme of the last week with, you know, lobbying and whatever else. MPs having a dressing down for being drunk on this flight to Gibraltar. Should they be given a dressing down? Are we being a bit prudish about all of this, India?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, people are always complaining that MPs aren't in touch with normal people's lives. And normal people, I observe whenever I'm at the airport, sometimes quite like having a pint at 8 a.m. before boarding their flight. And they travel as private citizens. I mean, it's not a good look, obviously, and it's a particularly bad look to have to be wheelchaired out. And if they were drunk, I really, really hope that they just say, you know, they got bladdered for a laugh rather than blame medication or deny being inebriated. But really, I think this is a kind of very good and appealing dead cat story. You know, we've got all this terrible, toxic stuff coming out of Sandhurst. We've got the murder of Agnes Wanjiru in Kenya in 2012. She was a 21-year-old young woman who had a child who was murdered by a British soldier and whose body was flung in a septic tank. The Sunday Times has done brilliant and stomach-churning reporting on this for the last couple of weeks. The British Army don't seem to be able to do anything about that. It's been nearly 10 years. They say they assist the Kenyan police and so on, but nothing has actually happened. So if I were Ben Wallace, I would make good use of the story of the drunk MPs to make everybody talk about that rather than about the really terrible and substantial stuff that needs very urgent addressing. And that's
such a good point, India, because we've had several stories in the last week from Ben Wallace briefing that he was hauling top brass in to give them a dressing down for this, that, and the other. Now he's giving MPs at a drink on a plane, a dressing down as well. And actually, you're completely right. The cultural, the story in Kenya is particularly terrible.
It's horrendous.
It's just awful. And the Sunday Times reporting of it has been extraordinary. But there were other stories in the Times last weekend, I think, of the culture at Sandhurst.
Yes, absolutely.
Any female recruits who went to a dinner that being groped was entirely normal. You know, racism, sexism, misogyny, all that. And so actually, punting out, maybe we should be a bit cynical about all of this, James.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's a kind of... it's an interesting line, isn't it? I enjoyed David Aronovich's column today about the how puritanical we should be about our politicians, and he argues that we should be very careful of the kind of slippery slope argument that one minute you're ignoring a kind of minor thing like drunkenness in a plane, and the next minute suddenly everyone's got a lot more corrupt, saying it's worse in foreign countries. I think I have a kind of instinctive feeling that if people want to get drunk on a plane, that's fine, and they should be allowed to. Speaking as a very non-fun person, I am in favour of more fun people than me having fun. But the point at which you're being wheelchaired off a plane and missing your work duties the next day, I think that probably is a problem.
It's a weird thing though, isn't it? Because we do with these things sort of have we sort of create these weird rules about if it's a sad day or a sad event. You know, how far in advance of Armistice Day must MPs be sober?
Yes, exactly. And then you get to this kind of thing where every possible day is a sad day. You can always look into the calendar and find it's the anniversary of something. You can punish someone for having too much fun on the anniversary of some incredibly small event. I think you're right that we should be a bit sceptical of going down that route of sort of probing every possible sad occasion it could be that someone could have done something slightly inappropriate, and accept that people probably are going to have fun, and it's not necessarily human nature to behave entirely appropriately all the time on every occasion with relevance to every single thing that might have an anniversary on that day.
Because we all get a bit of that, but I get that sometimes even on this show, because we're at 11 o'clock, we'll pause and we'll do the 2 minute silence, then we've got a nice feature about MPs who served in the First and Second World Wars, but before that we're going to play a bit of Aretha Franklin, and that if you wanted to, you could kick up a fuss about that. Why aren't we being sad for long? And the same was true of sort of the Duke of Edinburgh. How long do we have to be sad for before it becomes, in appropriate levels of sadness?
Yeah, I always think it's a real like Twitter thing as well. Because I feel before Twitter, there would be some newspaper just saying, okay, this is, drawing reasonable lines about things and generally drawing reasonable lines. But with Twitter, where it's a kind of free-for-all, absolutely everybody on Twitter has something to be offended about. Whenever you make a joke on Twitter, someone always will decide that relative to their own personal circumstance that you could not possibly have anticipated, you have somehow offended them with relevance to these kind of incredibly obscure facts. And it's that kind of, it's that culture that worries me where, everybody can get offended by something, and there has to be a line where we say, maybe some things are okay and maybe these are a bit minor.
It's also the pleasure that people take in being offended. Sometimes when I was on Twitter, when I did use social media, which I don't anymore, that you sort of sometimes get the sense that people are trawling timelines to find something to get cross about. I mean, it's a really odd, I'm saying it quite flippantly, but I think it's quite important and significant culturally. It's a really odd thing, the desire to be offended and the kind of the yearning for that little kind of kick of outrage that you get. It's not good. I don't think it should be encouraged.
No. Well, I think we've probably exhausted. Let's stop talking about the MPs there. Let's talk about your the much more straightforward issue of culture warriors that you've written about in your column today, James.
Yes, yeah. I woke up this morning and I was like, oh my God, why have I... I think it's a bit of a complicated one. I was thinking, on earth am I going to try and explain my idea about 14th century heretics on Times Radio. But the basic thesis of my column is, I've been reading this really, really interesting book, which I strongly recommend, about sort of mad heretics in the Middle Ages, called The Pursuit of the Millennium by Norman Cohn, who is kind of celebrated historian from the sort of earlier in the 20th century. And the basic thesis of his book, it's all about flagellants, people seeing visions of burning angels, these kind of strange revolutionary movements in the Middle Ages. And the basic thesis of his book is that the single biggest predicting factor of this complete madness that was going in the Middle Ages was the rise of the urban poor, and that basically all these incredibly mad movements can be explained by economics, even if that link doesn't necessarily seem rational, that people don't respond rationally to their economic circumstances. So all these people who ended up as flagellants, wandering between towns, whipping themselves and waiting for the apocalypse, you know, that was their reaction to their poverty rather than just, you know, joining a sort of sensible movement to the redistribution of wealth. And my basic thesis was that you can apply the same thesis to the kind of madness of the culture war and a lot of the slightly kind of bananas beliefs that end up floating around. You think about, you know, QAnon and top Democratic politicians being paedophiles. However mad they seem, I do think all this stuff ultimately reduces back to economics. So I was sort of, why the madness of the Middle Ages might tell us something about where we are now. Maybe it's even madder.
No, you took very well explaining that. Your take on it, India?
It's a really interesting take that would never have occurred to me in a million years. Very, very grateful to James. It's a really, I can see how that might work, how QAnon may stem from economic dissatisfaction. That makes perfect sense, more or less. I mean, I don't know how far out you can extend it to people who are not economically disadvantaged, James.
Yes, well, the thing everyone was going on at me in the comments was like, oh, well, what about all these woke people? Aren't they from very kind of well-off bourgeois backgrounds? And my answer to that is that I think I should have emphasised more in the column that I think sort of feeling of economic disadvantage is always relative. And I think it's been measured that I think, you know, inequality is in some ways worse for society than more, you know, absolute measures of economic disadvantage. And this is the point that Norman Cohn makes in his book, is that it wasn't that people hadn't been poor for the entire of the Middle Ages, but that later on in the Middle Ages, towns began to grow as the economy expanded. And what this created was this whole new class of people who were very poor, as they always had been in rural villages, but were right next to people who were much richer. And that's a much more kind of toxic thing to have in a society on a large scale. And I sort of think the internet is kind of like a giant medieval town in that case, that, you know, we're all sitting next to our big merchants.
That's true in lots of ways.
Yes, in every single way, with the public humiliations and the floggings and all that stuff.
That's the best.
And the person ringing their own bell, shouting, unclean, unclean.
Finally, India, there's a piece in Times 2 today about marrying young. Because of Malala.
Malala's done it. I'm so moved. Yeah, how old is Malala? 24?
I think so, 24, 25? 24.
I didn't know why I was so moved by the pictures of her on her wedding day. She got married in her parents' house in Birmingham. I liked the kind of modesty of the wedding as well. I liked that, you know, she's got a Nobel Prize and she's been on the cover of Vogue. And, you know, I liked that it was also kind of little and meant, I think, and good for her. I think they'll be very happy. She seems, you know, she seems, if people are going to get married young, then she seems like the sort of person who should. She's not racy, Malala. You know, I think she'll be very content. She'll be very content and very happy, and I wish her well.
Come on, James, she's putting pressure on you. Isn't it about time you got married?
Yeah, I know. Well, I look at those pictures, and there, I mean, Malala's like 5 years younger than me, and she looks, I mean, obviously, you know, They just look so grown up. I mean, obviously, Malala would be grown up being a Nobel Prize winner. But I'm just like, I feel like if I tried to get married, they could just be like, you're a child. Look at your sort of round, boyish face. What are you doing? Come back in 10 years.
I was 26, I think, when I got married.
Yeah, like 26.
26?
That's relatively young, I think.
That's quite young.
That's relatively young.
I was definitely like the first of my mates.
Yeah.
And then I had 10 years of attending their weddings of varying qualities.
Yeah, I don't know anyone. I've only got one friend who.
You've only got one. Blimey, James! Come on, who wants to be James's friend? Text us 8-7-2-1-2. Start your message with the word.
Can you acquire friends that way?
Here we are. There's a feature for Christmas. That'll run in one. Get James a friend. Well, at least you've got me in India. So that's two.
Are you really my friends?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I can speak on India's behalf.
No, absolutely.
There we go.
There we are. There
That's cheered me up on a Thursday.
Well, we hope we can all get together at some point, and we can. We'll get James married. India Knight and James Marriott there. And of course, you can read them in The Times and The Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, the MPs who fought and died in the First and Second World Wars.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right.
Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with five different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now, a special feature looking back at some of the MPs who fought and died in the First and Second World Wars. Today, we mark Armistice Day, commemorating the end of the First World War, remembering all those who've died in both the First and Second World Wars, fighting for Britain and the Allied forces. And of course, neither war was won from Parliament in Westminster, but it was at the centre of the action, not least during the Second World War, and is heavily damaged during the Blitz. But on the front line, 24 MPs died in military service during the First World War and 23 in the Second World War. So now we're going to hear from Dr. Catherine Wicks of the History of Parliament Trust with four stories of individual MPs, their parliamentary work and their military service. We begin with the grandson of a former Prime Minister who was killed in action.
On the 13th of April 1915, William Glyn Charles Gladstone, grandson of the late Prime Minister, became the second Member of Parliament to be killed in action during the First World War. He died at the age of 29 near La Vendée in France after being hit in the forehead by a rifle bullet as he tried to locate a German sniper. Gladstone was born in July 1885, just after the end of his grandfather's second term as Prime Minister. In September 1911, Gladstone was asked to stand at a by-election in Kilmarnock, where he was elected with an unexpectedly large majority. He wasn't a regular speaker in the Commons, but he made important contributions on the question of the disestablishment of the Welsh Church. He shared his grandfather's commitment to Home Rule for Ireland, speaking in support of the 1912 Government of Ireland Bill. When war broke out in 1914, Gladstone was involved with the recruiting campaign in Flintshire. Although he wrote in August that, "Far from having the least inclination for military service, I dread it and dislike it intensely," he enlisted himself. With the permission of the Prime Minister and the King, Gladstone's body was exhumed and brought back from France for burial alongside family members at St Daniel's Church, Howden. He was one of relatively few of those killed in action to be buried at home. His case prompted Major Fabian Ware to secure an order from the Adjutant General banning future repatriations, wishing to have equality for all classes in death. While in the trenches, Gladstone penned what seems a suitable epitaph, reflecting that it is not the length of existence that counts, for what is achieved during that existence, however short.
That was the story of William Glyn Charles Gladstone, the grandson of the former Prime Minister William Gladstone, who was the MP for Kilmarnock Burghs. Next, Dr. Catherine Wicks tells us of an MP who was the son of a former Chancellor and died in Egypt.
Michael Hugh Hicks Beach had served as Tewkesbury's Conservative MP for just over a decade when he was killed in action in Egypt on the 23rd of April 1916. He gained his first political experience as private secretary to his father, Michael Edward Hicks Beach, who had a distinguished ministerial career, notably as Chancellor of the Exchequer under Lord Salisbury. His family had long been settled in Gloucestershire, where his father and grandfather were both Conservative MPs. In 1904, Hicks Beach was chosen to contest the Tewkesbury division for the Conservatives at the next general election. Hicks Beach's victory for the Conservatives in 1906, in the face of a Liberal landslide across the country as a whole, was helped by his family's traditional local influence. But it also owed much to the frank and genial character of the young candidate himself and the sporting way in which he fought his campaign against apparent odds. Hicks Beach made his maiden speech on the Land Tenure Bill, and he took a particular interest in agricultural questions during his time in Parliament, where he was regarded as an effective speaker and generally well-liked. He saw action at Chocolate Hill, Gallipoli in August 1915, being mentioned in dispatches, and then went to Egypt. On the 23rd of April 1916, Hicks Beach was involved in severe fighting at Katia, 30 miles from the Suez Canal, where German and Turkish troops, some mounted on camels, made a surprise attack. Heavily outnumbered, the British withdrew. Hicks Beach was seriously wounded, but was rescued by Corporal William Castle, who, according to one account, under heavy Turkish fire, placed him across his horse and galloped 6 miles to safety. Sadly, Hicks Beach died of his wounds.
That was the story of Michael Hugh Hicks Beach, who was the MP for Tewkesbury. Of course, every story from the First World War is extraordinary, but some involve people who went on to later achieve incredible things. Like the story of Valentine Fleming, who was the father of Ian, who went on to create James Bond.
On the 25th of May 1917, the obituary of Valentine Fleming, Conservative MP for South Oxfordshire, appeared in the Times, following his death 5 days earlier on the Western Front. Its author, WSC, was none other than Winston Churchill. He'd known Fleming not only as a fellow MP, but also as an officer in the same yeomanry regiment. A framed copy of this obituary became one of the most cherished possessions of Fleming's son Ian, best known as the creator of James Bond. He was just about to turn 9 when his father died. Born in Fife in 1882, and in January 1907, he was chosen as the prospective Conservative candidate for South Oxfordshire. Fleming worked hard to cultivate support in the constituency, attending 30 meetings in his first 2 months as candidate. He won a convincing victory over his Liberal opponent in January 1910. However, by April 1913, he decided that he wouldn't stand again when the next election took place. When war broke out in 1914, Fleming, now a captain, enlisted for service with his regiment. He fought at the Battle of Ypres, was twice mentioned in dispatches, and was promoted to the rank of major. In the early hours of 20th of May 1917, Fleming was one of 5 members of his squadron killed in a heavy German bombardment while defending Gillemont Farm in northern France. Valentine Fleming was posthumously awarded the Distinguished Service Order. Churchill remembered his lovable and charming personality, while a fellow officer wrote that the loss to the regiment is indescribable. He was absolutely our best officer, utterly fearless, full of resource, and perfectly magnificent with his men.
That was the story of Valentine Fleming, the MP for South Oxfordshire and father of Ian Fleming, the Bond author. And finally, from Dr. Catherine Hicks, a tale of the only MP killed in the First World War to have served in the Royal Flying Corps.
Francis McLaren, the Liberal MP for Spalding, was killed in a flying accident on the 30th of August 1917 while training with the Royal Flying Corps. His plane crashed into the sea a mile off the Scottish coast at Montrose. He was rescued by a fishing boat but didn't regain consciousness and died of his injuries before reaching land. McLaren is the only MP among those killed during the First World War to have served in the Royal Flying Corps. Paying tribute to him in the Commons later that year, the former Prime Minister Asquith, whose son and daughter had been a page boy and bridesmaid at McLaren's wedding in 1911, declared that "We've lost one of our youngest and most loved of our members, who was cut off in a youth of radiant promise, still untarnished by disappointment, a man with clear and firm conviction, a faithful and loyal friend." McLaren was first elected for the Spalding Division of Lincolnshire in January 1910, when he became the youngest Liberal member of the Commons, aged 23. He was commissioned as a lieutenant in September 1914 and left for France in October. According to his fellow MP, Josiah Wedgwood, McLaren had got overseas by offering his Rolls-Royce car to the general with himself as chauffeur. In early May, Wedgwood was injured by shrapnel, and he credited McLaren with saving his life after he searched for him on the hospital ship and insisted that he be operated on immediately. In Wedgwood's absence, it was McLaren who commanded the armoured cars in a futile attack on the Turkish defences at the Third Battle of Krithia on the 4th of June, the only time they were used during this campaign. Having contracted dysentery, McLaren recovered at home. He was then commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Royal Flying Corps on the 1st of January 1916. He suffered ill health during his training at Brooklands, but he lobbied the War Office to protest against this decision and was reappointed in June 1917. He'd almost completed his advanced training when he was killed.
That was the story of Francis McLaren, told by Dr. Catherine Wicks from the History of Parliament Trust. We also heard of the stories of William Gladstone, Michael Hugh Hicks Beach, and Valentine Fleming. Coming up, Labour MP and the biographer of Parliament Chris Bryant on how the Commons functioned with so many MPs serving overseas during the two world wars, and former soldier turned MP Tom Tugendhat on the impact of serving on his role as a politician. This is Matt Chorley on Times Radio in association with Mastercard Strive, empowering small businesses for a digital future.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Join me, Mariella Frostrup, for in-depth discussion of the day's topical news stories. Plus, hear exclusive interviews with new and leading creative voices from the worlds of art, literature, film, music, and more. Explore the ideas that shape our times with original perspectives from across the political and cultural spectrum.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from MasterCard, empowering small businesses for a digital future. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
This is Matt Chorley on Armistice Day, reflecting on the role of MPs serving in the world wars.
So I'm joined now by the Labour MP, Chris Bryant, who's written both a biography of Parliament and a book, The Glamour Boys, about the soldiers who left Westminster and influenced the wall. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
In your time picking through the history of Parliament, how many parliamentarians fought in each war?
Oh, fought? I mean, hundreds, both in the First World War and in the Second World War. And if you go in Westminster Hall, the great hall that's been there since just after the Norman Conquest, right at the top of the steps, there's a memorial to the MPs, the sons of MPs, and the members of the House of Lords and staff of the House of Commons who were killed in the First World War. And ironically enough, the kind of angel at the top of it was hit in the Second World War. But it's interesting because you've got, all three leaders of the political parties in the First World War lost sons in the First World War. Asquith most famously lost his favourite son, who was killed, and subsequently, 2 weeks later, Lloyd George and Winston Churchill moved against him to have him removed as Prime Minister.
And actually, one of the striking things, we do a thing on the show every Monday where we look back on a different Prime Minister each week, and we sort of reached a period now, the sort of 50s and 60s, where the Prime Ministers themselves had served or, like you said, had lost people. And that actually, it had a big impact, didn't it, on just the psychology of the people who were running the country and then went on to run the country.
Well, I think it was very difficult, for instance, for Anthony Eden, who'd seen action in the First World War and seen horrors that he never wanted to see again. But, there are moments, extraordinary moments, like when Winston Churchill had to ring up the head of the garrison at Calais as the evacuation was happening at Dunkirk to tell the garrison commander, who was the brother of a fellow Conservative MP, you have to stay and you will never be able to surrender, because it was so important that they kept on going, and most of them lost their lives there. And a terribly sad story too about Ronnie Cartland, Barbara Cartland's younger brother. In fact, he should never have served in the armed forces at all, because he had literally shot himself in the foot an accident at school, and then he managed to have his ankle shorn off on a motorbike accident as well in 1926. But he managed to steer his way around the official medical, joined up to the Territorial Army. He was a passionate opponent of Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement. Neville Chamberlain hated him. He was one of the people that Chamberlain called the glamour boys as a way of deriding them and suggesting that there was something effeminate about him. He was gay and had lots of gay friends. When it came to the war, he joined the British Expeditionary Force. They went out to France and Belgium. And at the key point at the end of May, when the British are evacuating via Dunkirk, every extra hour saved against the German advance is vital, of course. And there's a little town perched on a sort of mound in the middle of Flanders Field called Cassel, which had been used in the First World War. Ronnie was in charge of the anti-tank brigade at Cassel. They were surrounded by Germans. The message got back far too late for them to be able to retreat, but it was absolutely essential that they stayed there that extra day, because it meant another 100,000 Brits British soldiers were able to evacuate from Dunkirk. Anyway, they left late at night under cover of darkness. They had to muffle their boots as they left. They had to destroy all their equipment at Cassel. And it's one of the very few occasions in British history when everybody was told it's every man for himself. They had to make their way as best they possibly could to Dunkirk in the hopes of evacuation. Ronnie was with some of his troops when they were caught by a panzer division. And as Ronnie stood up, he was shot in the head. And when his sister, Barbara Cartland, and mother were told of this a few months later, when the news got back to them, and they discovered that his younger brother, Tony, had died as well, about 5 miles away the day before.
Wow. I mean, and I suppose there were so many of these stories repeated again and again and again every day. And what impact did it have on the House of Commons and the operation of Parliament? If so many were not there because they were serving and then they died too, what did that mean for the terms of, you know, the operation of Parliament, the representation of areas if they lost MPs? Were there by-elections during the war?
There were by-elections. Well, I mean, the main thing was, of course, that the Parliaments Act, which said that you had to have elections every 5 years, was suspended several times, both in the First World War and in the Second World War. So we didn't have general elections, but we did have by-elections, and on the whole, not all the opponent parties tended not to stand, but then you had other political parties come into existence solely to stand in the election because they disagreed with the way that the war was being conducted. And you had, I mean, probably the biggest effect was on the House of Lords, because in the Second World War, they were lucky if they got into double figures of attendance in the House of Lords. They were, of course, not sitting in the chamber of the House of Lords. The Commons were sitting in the Lords, and the Lords were sitting in the Royal Robing Room. But they hardly, they hardly needed that. They could have sat in broom cupboard, to be honest. And it's one of the things that I think eventually meant that we had to have life peerages, because otherwise the House of Lords simply wasn't going to survive. Now, whether that in the end was the right decision is a matter for constitutional historians to battle over. But and sometimes, of course, MPs, when they were off, another gay MP, as it happens, Jack McNamara, who was colonel of the London Irish Rifles, he was desperate to fight, to be given a command in a place of real battle. On the whole, the government didn't want to put MPs in places where they might get captured, because that would be an additional sort of fillip for the Germans or for our opponents. So they tended to be put in rather boring jobs, looking after aerodromes in Northern Ireland or whatever. Jack did eventually get out to the Middle East, or to Africa rather, and then to the Adriatic, and was one of the first people to go into a liberated Athens, and ended up being killed when he was with his former troops on the River Senia. But when he was away, all his correspondence was looked after by his next door neighbour, who was actually a Labour MP, Tom Dryburgh.
That was Chris Byrne, the Labour MP and biographer of Parliament. His book, The Glamour Boys, is terrific on that group of MPs, who, as he said, were disparaged, but actually served with great distinction during the World Wars. Well, let's look now at today's politics. And 45 of today's MPs have served in the armed forces as either a regular or reservist, which is about 7% of the House of Commons. Actually higher than the 5% of people in the general public who've got military experience. So what is it about working in the army that leads people to want to then become an MP? Tom Tugendhat is MP for Tunbridge and Malling, chairs the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, but served in both the Iraq War and the war in Afghanistan, and joins me now. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Matt. How are you?
I'm very good. This feels like, after starting with the tales of the First and Second World Wars, just to sort of bring it up to date. There's obviously a sort of a long history of people going from the military into politics, which actually I was quite struck by those figures that even I was surprised actually was as many as 45 of the current crop of the House of Commons who've served as well.
Yeah, no, I'm not that surprised. I mean, there's a small gang of us. There's people like Sarah Atherton and Johnny Mercer and David Davis. And, I mean, there's quite a few of us of various generations and various levels of experience. And I think that's a really good thing.
And what does just describe us first of all what your military career, and then we'll talk about how that influences your politics. Where did you serve? When did you serve?
Yeah, so I did a few years with a Royal Marines unit, or alongside a Royal Marines unit rather, as an intelligence officer, and it was fantastic fun. I served some of the best people I've ever met, and had the great good fortune to go with them to Iraq and then later to Afghanistan, and had a very interesting time. I also worked for the Foreign Office and did a few other things too, which was really good fun.
And then was it natural for you to go from that into politics? Was that something you always had in mind?
It wasn't something I'd always had in mind, but it was certainly something that I got more and more interested in. I mean, not just because, you know, being in the army, you're on the front line of public policy, frankly. I mean, your government ideas are what you're sent in to do. But you're working with people from across the United Kingdom. And for me, that was what was most interesting. You know, many of us, I'm sure not you, Matt, but many of us live in our very own bubbles of people we went to school with or people we live near or whatever it is. But one of the great things about the armed forces is you're forced together with people from not just across the United Kingdom, actually, but across the Commonwealth. And that's fantastic. You know, I worked with one guy who was a sergeant major, an extraordinary, wonderful Royal Marine sergeant major, who had been in foster care on and off from the age of three. And I worked with another guy who, you know, his grandmother did OK. She ended up as Queen of the United Kingdom. So, you know, there's a whole sort of range of people who you can work with.
And what is the value, do you think, of having veterans in the House of Commons today?
Well, I mean, I think it's important that we have people from sort of every walk of life. I think it's important to have veterans. Of course it is. But it's also important to have, you know, doctors and lawyers and business people and people who are shop workers and people who are social workers. And, you know, I mean, the House of Commons should represent the United Kingdom as best as possible. And when it's best, it does it very well. And, you know, I think veterans are an important part of our community, of our society. And so I see that as an important community to represent. But, you know, I am one, so I would say that, wouldn't I?
And there are, you know, there are, like I was saying, there are reservists in the House of Commons, too. And there's also been this big debate in the last week or so about what MPs get up to and what they do outside the House of Commons too. I mean, there's clearly a massive difference between serving your country and being a lobbyist.
Well, I think there is, but I mean, you know, it's up to you to judge. Look, I think there are many people who bring experience to the House of Commons in many, many different ways, and I think that really matters. You know, if you want a cadre of professional politicians who know nothing else other than politics and have grown up as special advisors, fine. But that's a very different kind of representation that you'll get. You'll get effectively a government of bureaucrats rather than a government of representatives. No, that's just a different thing.
And how do you feel about the state of the military today? And it does feel like there's quite a lot of sort of problems crossing Ben Wallace's desk as Defence Secretary, whether it's this terrible story about the woman who was murdered in Kenya, the talk of the culture in the armed forces more generally as well. What do you make of the state of the armed forces?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I think I won't be alone. In fact, I know I'm not alone in being utterly appalled by the alleged murder of the woman in Kenya. I mean, it's completely horrific. And I'm delighted that the army is doing absolutely everything it can to help with the investigation. It's absolutely the right thing to do, and there's no question about it. But I am concerned at the size of the army. It is, frankly, too small. We're now down to about 70-odd thousand. And if you look at the Royal Navy, you know, we have a couple of major capital ships in the two aircraft carriers. But the reality is we don't have the fleet needed to escort them. You know, we have invested in the armed forces a bit recently. But given the fact that we're now being challenged in the South Pacific, we're being challenged in Eastern Europe, and indeed the United States has in various different ways put pressure on various of its allies to take more of the burden, quite understandably. We need to think about whether it is, you know, whether the UK still wants to be a rule maker or wants to become a rule taker, because if you don't invest in your defence, if you don't choose to shape allies and influence by many different ways, you know, not just the armed forces, but through aid and trade and various other things as well, then I'm afraid that's what you're choosing. And sadly, our military is now too small, and it's the direction we're taking.
Just finally, because we've been talking about the military, we just need to reflect on the this story about the three MPs accused by the Defence Secretary of disrespecting the armed forces by getting drunk on a flight to visit troops in Gibraltar. It's obviously one Labour MP, two SNP MPs. What do you make of this?
Well, two of them at least deny it, so I'm not sure how true it is. But I have to say, if that is true, it'd be pretty rubbish, frankly. I mean, it's just not good behaviour.
Tom Tugendhat, really good to speak to you. Thanks very much for joining us. Tom Tugendhat there, former soldier, now Conservative MP and chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Just rounding off our special half an hour here on Times Radio, which began with marking the 2 minute silence of Armistice Day, of course, the 11 o'clock on the 11th of the 11th. Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bit of my Times Radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB online via smart speaker or on the Times Radio app. And if you want to read more about all of the stories that we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't know,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.